All right. Well, thank you all so much for spending the day here today, and I'm so glad we got to share Mass with each other as part of this day of retreat. What I want to talk about for the last talk about welcoming the stranger, you know, is more about what you may be afraid is going to happen when you reach out to people who aren't kind of naturally falling into your life, when you open your home, when you try and evangelize, which is you're going to wind up in a disagreement. And you're going to wind up kind of stuck in a disagreement that doesn't feel fruitful. Because I think, you know, it's good for us to be generous with our faith. It's good for us to put our faith out there. But not all encounters we have for the sake of evangelization are fruitful. And it can be hard to pull ourselves out of, you know, patterns of sin and anger or resentment. It can be hard for the person we're talking to listen. So I'm going to talk about it as a way to be kind of really hospitable, even in the midst of a disagreement. I'm going to talk about one overarching principle for trying to approach fights hospitably. And then, you know, two ways you can think about what you're doing for yourself in the fight and what you're doing for the person you're in a disagreement with. And really, the first thing that I think is the most helpful principle to kind of get a hold of yourself and think about how you're engaging someone is to think about kind of what I call a principle of symmetry, which is you have to treat the other person, the person you're trying to get to change their mind or to give ground or to convert or anything else, the way you would need to be treated to change your mind. And you've heard a little bit, if you were here last night, and kind of a little bit anyway, about kind of all the things people did for me to make it possible for me to convert, you know, which went well beyond just having a really like impressive lists of reasons that I should or had to convert and kind of bludgeoning me over the head with them till I gave in. But also weren't kind of standing back totally passive, waiting for me to generate all my questions myself. I think one of the biggest things I've learned through my own conversion, through my conversations with other people who are thinking about it and just changing my mind on anything generally, is that it's a relay race. You know, and it's such a comfort to me as a Christian. It's different than when I was an atheist to know that I can be helpful to someone without finishing the argument, without kind of coming to an end in that encounter, because I can trust in a way I couldn't before that when what we're discussing is about truth, God is always fighting for both of us and isn't going to leave off even once this conversation ends. But so a lot of what I think is helpful, especially in kind of the most hot button issues, if you wind up drawn into arguments about church doctrine, about contraception, about gay marriage, about anything else, is to think about how someone would have to approach you if they wanted you to uproot your life in so dramatic a way as what the church is asking other people to do. What would it mean for someone to say to you, look, like, your marriage is invalid, like, and I'm saying this in love. I know that sounds weird, right? But I genuinely believe that this isn't God's will for you, and it would be more fruitfully expressed a different way. Which is, I think whenever I kind of frame that in terms of symmetry of what it would mean for someone to tell me that my husband and I should separate, you know, or live together as brother and sister at best, you know, it's certainly not something I'd be amenable to hearing from a stranger. The thing I'd have to hear first is really a strong belief that this person does love me and knows something about me before my response to that would be anything other than, I think my husband would actually, like, is more patient than I am, like, before my response might be just, you know, for assessing my marriage. So I think a lot of that, you know, when you think about kind of that principle of symmetry, part of it is what do you need to be able to have this conversation when it's stressful, when it's difficult, and how can you give that to the other person? You know, and one of the simplest things that I find I need is breathing room in a discussion, right? That it's easier for me to talk and to consider changing my mind when I don't have to talk constantly, even though you can tell I like talking constantly. But when there's room for me to think, and I think that's something we seldom have naturally in our disagreements. You know, and one of the easiest ways I've found to even just make space is to have disagreements with people over meals, where, you know, there's something about pausing to say, wait, I need to think about what you said. I'm not sure how to respond, feels cowardly, even though it's actually brave, to admit I don't know what's going on, to not go beyond what I can say confidently, but to ask, to make myself vulnerable to the person who's disagreeing with me by saying, that's an interesting point and I don't know how to answer to you, I need a minute, is hard. And I can't assume it's going to be true that the person I'm speaking to will be able to ask for that for themselves from me. So I find it helpful to disagree over a meal where I can just like put more food in my mouth. And suddenly I don't feel like a coward. I feel like someone who is hungry and not talking and thinking. So I think that that first principle of symmetry, what do you need to be able to have a disagreement, to have room to think at all? And how can you both give that to yourself and give that to the person you're talking to who may not even feel like they trust you enough to ask for it? You know, if you had to run out early to get back to work or pick up kids, like, and just leave with that idea of symmetry, what do I need to feel safe to consider something scary? How can I give that to me and the person I'm disagreeing with? I think you could generate over time the entire rest of my talk, because I think it's all animated by loving your neighbor as yourself. But if you're willing to stick around, I have a few kind of more specific things I try and do to make that space and to love my neighbor. That really help me, that are all derived from that principle of symmetry. So to start with, it's what do I need to do for myself and in myself to be able to engage at all? You know, and I really am trying for two things. I'm trying for comfort and compassion. Comfort first, because the more I can kind of walk back from a war footing, from a lot of anxiety or anything else, the easier it is for me to hear the other person, for me to talk to them. And that's not always, that's not necessarily like where I start as the disagreement breaks out. I don't start in this relaxed, like, how will we explore truth together? How can I show you I love you spot, right? So sometimes I kind of start from a different emotional register, which I might describe as, how can you be so wrong, right? And what I find, like, the great blessing is, you know, God would like me to like wind up somewhere very different, but he's given me tools to get just even a little closer to seeing this person as he does. And for me, like the big trick is moving from anger to curiosity. And anger to curiosity isn't as hard a step as like my end goal, anger to compassion. But I can do curiosity easier because I actually don't have to change any of the words I just said. All I have to do is shift from, how can you be so wrong? To, how can you be so wrong? You can hear, it's like a baby step, right? But for me, the difference is that the more I'm in that spot of anger of, how can you be so wrong, right? The more all I want from my opponent is for them to like look like a beaten dog and apologize to me. Maybe you are all like a more charitable audience than I am personally. But there's this like little part of me that really, like in an argument, isn't striving for truth so much as for dominance, right? Especially, I hope not entirely, like for the sake of beating down the person I'm talking to, a little bit for the sake of defending what I'm defending, which kind of only feels safe after a full concession. As I'm kind of going and going, I'm waiting for the person to go, I'm sorry, Leah, you were right and I was wrong. I shouldn't have disagreed with you. And the trouble with that is, you know, that's not very vibrant as an end of a discussion. I talked about in my speech last night about my conversion that even when I was an atheist kind of attacking the faith of my Christian friends, I didn't just want them to be not Christian. I didn't want them to go, I'm sorry for being Catholic, now I'm not, right? I mean, I wanted it a little bit, right? But the reason I couldn't just want that is it's insufficient. No one can live just as someone who's conceded a point. Like, they need to pick up something else and live it. So the more I'm just seeking to beat down my opponent, the more I'm trying to make them small and less, like the less I'm fighting to win anything. So when I can move from, how can you be so wrong, to how can you be so wrong, it gives me the chance to want something that isn't just my opponent being brutalized and conceding. Because if I get to that point, but I don't understand the answer to how could you be so wrong, I won't be satisfied. Suddenly, I need to know something particular about this person. What is it like to be so wrong? Like, do you not notice all the ways that you're wrong? Are you so wrong that those things feel right? Like, even though it all sounds very condescending in my head, and like you should try and filter it a little bit as it comes out of your mouth, it really shifts me from a position of just trying to lecture to really asking questions to which I want to know the answer. Questions that aren't meant as just like a trap, where once they give an answer, I'm like, ah, so you see that you are stupid, right? Like, questions where I'm no longer trying to control the whole conversation and lead it down railroad tracks to like their inevitable baptism, right? But where I'm really taking a moment to see them as a person, and I need to know something about them, not just about what I have. This helps me a lot, and sometimes like this is as far as I go, depending on kind of how agitated I am, how well I know the person, how everything else is going. But instead of just moving from anger to curiosity, when I can, I want to move from curiosity to compassion. Because as long as I'm just on curiosity, I'm kind of, me especially, prone to, I'm looking at this person as an individual, but I'm not quite looking at them as a son or daughter of God. At least I'm not, right? I can kind of shift from looking at them as just like something to be beaten down to an interesting intellectual puzzle, like a crossword or a Sudoku, right? Where I'm like, all right, like, how can you be so wrong? Let me just like look at all the pieces and just move them around a little bit till I get it, right? And that's better, but it's not true. Like, you know, and that's the kind of thing where even when I'm arguing for something that's true, like the faith, I want to be arguing it in a manner that doesn't distance me from the truth of the faith. And the more I see someone as to be, you know, beaten down or even just to be solved like a puzzle, I'm still not quite myself in touch with the truth of the faith, and I want to get further. So for me, the question that helps me go further is now not just asking, how can you be so wrong, but what are you in love with that you're defending from me? Because someone who is a lover, I cannot simply be a set of intellectual propositions. That someone who loves is a person. And looking at how someone loves makes me fonder of them, even if what they love is really, really stupid. And part of the reason is that in Don Quixote, right, we see a man who's in love with ideals of chivalry and puts them into practice in a way that is farcical. You know, he seizes upon a barber's wash bin and makes of it a helmet. And so it's not that all his choices are noble, but they're motivated by a kind of nobility. But our reaction to Quixote, you know, venerating this wash bowl, shouldn't be to slap it out of his hands and go, stop loving that, that's dumb, right? Like, no. It's really, wow, what a powerful love you have for something that's like relatively nuts. If only your love had a better object. I don't want to lessen your love one iota. I don't want to see you cowed and beaten and giving up. But this really isn't like the highest good that's worthy of the love you're bringing to it. And for me, a lot of the time when I start to think of my opponent as a lover, it becomes much harder to want them to just shrink away and concede, because that would mean muting the passion of their love. I want to understand now what they love, not only as a puzzle, but because, you know, sometimes what I find is that this person loves something real, something I myself am neglecting. That even if I'm right on the whole in our argument, they might be right about something that is a good, maybe a lesser good, that I'm not really taking into account. And I learn something, and I have that love kindled in me. Sometimes we just have a disagreement where we both agree that what they love is a good, you know, and we just kind of disagree practically on whether or not what I'm arguing for endangers it or not. But we can kind of notice at that point, oh, you know, we both are pledged to this good. We just need to figure out how best to serve it. But we're on the same side. We're just disagreeing about tactics.
Give an example.
Sure. If I kind of disagree with someone about how to arrange a school, but we agree that we're both kind of interested in education to form people to be saints of God, and we're kind of disagreeing about how much the whole school curriculum has to be written from a Christian theme, or, you know, sending someone to public school, but, you know, otherwise forming them outside of that in religious education. You know, we both agree on what the goal is, but we might not notice that at first in the disagreement. The more heated we get, and the more like, well, you just don't care if people are contaminated by sin. Yes, I do, right? Like, until we pause and go, what are we trying to do here? we both agree we want people to be saints. Like, we're disagreeing about what we can trust or what we should place our trust in to make that happen. Versus if I'm having a different disagreement about how schools should be set up with someone who goes, yeah, school is like primarily about making people good citizens, but, you know, not about moral education. I'm like, whoa, we disagree at a different level here. And then I'm kind of in the situation where I'm like, you know, I can agree with your good to an extent, because I do think school is also about that. But I think it's a lesser good, and there's a higher good that hasn't entered into your side of the argument at all. So now, you know, I don't even want to attack your love of this lesser good, but I want to kind of bring out my higher good to show you and see if I can get you to fall in love with it. So that's kind of the motion I'm trying to go through for myself, from anger to curiosity to love, to seeing the other person as a lover, understanding what they love, and being able to tell them honestly whether it's something I love also, I love in a different degree, or whether it's something I think is genuinely a pernicious false love, but I want to see their love attached to something more worthy of them. So that's kind of the arc I'm trying to go through. For my opponent, I'm trying to do something a little different, because of course, they haven't necessarily signed on to my project of let me try and reframe this argument, right? So I can kind of do things more explicitly to myself, I have to do implicitly for them. So for me, it's curiosity and compassion. For them, it's curiosity and comfort. Curiosity first, again, simply because when I'm arguing with someone, they're actually not obliged to argue with me at all, which isn't the stance people always take on the internet, where it kind of like, there's this implicit, because I have just yelled at you, you have to give me the next hour of your life. Like, I just yelled at you, therefore you have to answer me. And that's very crazy. Like, that's not the approach I tend to take when I'm being reasonable to people who yell at me in the internet or in real life. They don't get to jump to the top of my to-do list by being rude. So I don't want to use that tactic, just the mere naked fact of my disagreement, to try and bully people into sitting still for my argument. I want them to want to talk to me. And so for me, that means that they have to also have something they're curious about my position. And it might be my job to give it to them, because they're not necessarily trying to make that, how can Leah be so wrong, shift themselves. And so for me, sometimes that means, especially when evangelizing about the faith, that I'm not trying to lead even with an argument or my strongest argument for the existence of God. You know, especially because it may be a really long argument that they have no reason to sign on for. Again, folks who were here Monday night heard my long and philosophically dense conversion story, which I can't quite like go out as a sidewalk preacher and go, let me give you some background on the history of philosophy. No, no, sit through this whole part. It's 20 minutes long, and then I'll talk to you about God. Because people reasonably don't have to listen to me do that. So what I want to lead with is something that I think will just spark curiosity, and perhaps even light curiosity, the kind of curiosity that doesn't feel dangerous to indulge, which may really mean just sharing something that moves me about the faith or something that is strange about the faith. You know, so I'm, for an example, and this isn't intended as a fight that I'm trying to start, but on December 8th is going to be the canonization of the Trappist monks who were martyred in Algeria, whose story is told in the film Of Gods and Men. And I found their life and their story incredibly moving. It was something that really changed my understanding of what martyrdom was. Because especially from outside the faith, martyrdom seemed more like a seeking after glory. You know, I'm going to run out and get martyred, you know, and that will be the most badass thing. But when I saw the lives of these monks, you know, it was much less that they were ever seeking death, and more that they were seeking God, and they wouldn't budge from where God was even when death overtook them. And so when they stayed in the middle of a war zone to keep serving the people in the community who had, you know, depended on them, never were they saying, let's all go be martyred. You know, martyrdom, really glorious, a great path to sainthood. They're just going, these are our people and we can't leave them. I hope nothing bad happens to us, but it's really not up to us whether we live or die. What's up to us is to serve. I found their story so moving. And so this is We're going to host a movie night, me and my husband, to watch Of Gods and Men that night to celebrate their lives and their witness. And we're inviting friends who aren't Catholic because the movie is good. And it's not even that we're explicitly picking a fight, but we're giving our friends something to ask us about and something to be curious about. I don't always do this at movie length, yes. It's Of Gods and Men. It's available on DVD. It is subtitled because it's in French and Arabic, I believe. I'd completely recommend doing this yourself. December 8th is their canonization. Stirring up curiosity in my opponent can really mean just sharing something I find beautiful or striking. And then the closer the friend is that I'm really trying to do this with, even something that I feel vulnerable about. You know, instead of making an argument about the faith, sometimes the way I'm trying to stir curiosity is just saying, like, you know, wow, like, I'm struggling to find time in my day for prayer and I feel bad about that. Like, and just talking about my feelings to a friend who isn't Catholic, who isn't invested in me making more time for prayer, but is invested in me as a friend, and is interested in talking about my faith in this context of supporting me, whether or not they're kind of interested in it for the sake of my soul. And they're more curious about something that involves my need than they are in something that involves my lecturing them. That's kind of about creating curiosity. And when it comes to creating comfort for my opponent, you know, a lot of that is really drawn from what symmetry involves, what is involved to give them space, what's involved to give them breathing room. How can I make it clear that by arguing with me, they haven't signed up to be locked in a room with me until we settle this, right? Which I think how a lot of arguments feel, where sometimes like what feels more comfortable and then safer to explore the question at all is simply having it at a time when we know we have to stop and being willing myself, especially at a moment that doesn't feel like a triumph for me, going like, wow, I really enjoy talking about this. Thank you for making the time. Like, obviously, we're not settling this today, but I'm really glad we talked about it. So that it's clearer that they can leave the argument without, you know, feeling like they falsely conceded something by not winning. And something that feels important to me, because I struggle with this, about walking away from a fight. I once in college got into a really high-stakes argument about whether the female characters in Stephen Sondheim's musical Assassins were fully fleshed out given the constraints of the historical figures they were based on. And so, like, this was a really loud argument I got into, and it, like, didn't stop. So I was arguing with my friend Dylan from when we finished seeing the show, which was around, like, 11, and then, like, till, like, 1 o'clock in the morning. And this is in college, right? And at 1 in the morning, I was really tired, and I wanted to stop having this discussion. And I couldn't figure out how to stop having this discussion. Because, you know, what was going on in my head, which I will concede now that it's not 1 in the morning, was slightly crazy. It was just like, if I tell Dylan I want to go to bed because I'm tired, he's going to think that I want to go to bed because I know he's really right, and I'm, like, too much of a coward to concede it, right? And, like, this felt so reasonable at that time. And I kind of had to really walk myself through, like, wait, really? Like, in my head, and going, like, okay, so I tell him I'm tired and I go to bed. Like, what happens then? I'm like, well, he thinks I have no intellectual honesty, like, and is disgusted with me. I'm like, okay, and then what? And he goes, and I guess he tells all of our friends, like, and he could do that because he's still awake and I'll be asleep and he'll have time to, like, email all of them while I'm asleep about what a coward I am, and then they'll never respect me. And I'm like, wait, if I got this email from Dylan, like, would I think that the person being described was, like, a coward, or would I think Dylan was crazy? And I'm like, I would definitely think Dylan was crazy. And so I kind of had to walk myself all the way through this, by which points I'm doing this, like, in my brief snatches of thinking in between arguing, like, it's 2 in the morning. And I'm like, Dylan, I'm really tired and I want to go to bed. And he goes, okay. Like, I think so often the things that are making it hard for someone to listen to us aren't even anything we're saying. It's all the anxiety they have and that we have about what it means to be in an argument about something that matters and how to represent our side well and how to feel safe doing it. And we really have to go much further than we expect to quiet those kind of voices of fear and anxiety for a friend, to make it clear, you know, throughout that we care for them, that we're having this fight because we care for them, and that we're not demanding of them something they can't give us honestly during this fight to continue to respect them. I also think that, you know, kind of the push to defeat someone in one argument is always a bad idea. Because anything you can argue someone into in one session, someone can argue them out of in another. Because they haven't had enough time to really let the idea grow and steep within them and to discern what it is. I think we as Catholics need to be careful, kind of, we have such a rich and deep faith. None of us can defend all of it at once, like on the spot. So to really model that it's all right in an argument to go, I don't know the answer to that. That's not a question that's bothered me before. You know, that's not something I've studied. You know, that, you know, question or, you know, difficulty you have wasn't a sticking point in my conversion, so I never looked as deeply at it. And be honest and go, I'd be happy to try and find someone or read something and talk to you more about it. But yeah, I definitely can't defend every part of my worldview on the spot, and I don't expect you to either. I don't expect that if I ask you a question you stumble with, that then you have to give up or, you know, be a liar. Like, I want you to come back with to me with your best defense of your position, and it's fine if you need more time to do that. You know, to really be generous in that way. And one of the simplest kinds of ways of making arguments comfortable is the obvious one, which is not to have them online in front of everyone else that you know. Where, you know, of all those times, going back to that idea of symmetry, you know, where is it hardest for me to say, hang on, like, that point did rattle me, I need to think about it? Obviously, that's hardest for me to do on my Facebook wall in front of everyone. So the more intimate the fight, the more I want to do it somewhere that is intimate and private, where nothing my friend is saying is kind of going to be quoted or referenced later, where there's almost room to be playful, you know, and to explore and to go like, well, let me try this out. I'm not sure about it, you know, so don't quote me on this. But here's what I'm thinking about. No one has that space online. So it's important to get offline and try and make space that really leaves people safe to be curious and to think new thoughts. I'll tell you a story about one way in which I did this that was kind of a more extravagant way. Again, you can just meet someone for coffee, especially, again, meeting them going like, do you have an hour to continue talking about this? Obviously, we won't sort the whole thing out, but like, I'm really curious about this point you made or this author you referenced. Start with something that they can give you, right? In my case, what happened to me was that I'd written an article about Brendan Eich, a software developer who worked on Firefox and Mozilla, who supported an anti-gay marriage referendum and then was asked to resign as CEO of his company. I wrote a piece about this, and there was kind of like a rapid-fire Facebook discussion going on under it. And I like tried to make it better on Facebook, and my results were limited, right? Where I'm like, you know, people are going like, pow, 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 adding comments, we're all not doing our jobs at work, right? And I'm like, guys, what if we each like committed to set a 1 minute timer before we post a next comment just so that the thread slows down a little bit and people don't feel pressured to reply? I'm like, what if in this thread we all tried to restate each other's arguments before commenting ourselves? I'm like, what if instead of doing this on my Facebook wall, you did it at my house and I made you cookies? What kind of cookies? I'm away for work this weekend, but I'm available next weekend. Like, can we do it as a formal debate according to Robert's Rules of Order? Like, nerds, right? Like, and so that helped, right? And one of the big things that helps, it moved it from kind of a genre of argument everyone knows how to engage in, but it's bad, like all the traditions of it are bad, to at least something that either was more familiar to my debate friends or completely unfamiliar to my non-debate friends, where they had no previous bad habits associated with it. So I had everyone over. And, you know, some of the things I did, you don't have to learn Robert's Rules of Order and conduct a formal debate. I happen to have a gavel, right? coincidentally. But some of the things I did were really intended, before the debate even began, to really shift the context in which we were arguing. I think this is kind of one of my last techniques, which is really, you know, making sure the format of your argument tells the truth. The internet doesn't tell us the truth about an argument because, again, it's kind of moving us back to how can you be so wrong at best, right? Where everyone else is just their text. just their propositions to be kind of rebutted and pieced apart and argued with, but not people. And, you know, sometimes people are like, well, you know, isn't it truer intellectually to just engage with the ideas, to kind of sever them from the people and not be biased by the fact you like this person, so you go easy on them? And I, like, feel the pull of this thought sometimes. But I've rejected it, because the fullness of truth is that we are all made to be saints together in heaven with God. Like, and that's the most bedrock truth there is. And everything else comes second to that. So anything that's kind of clouding my view of other people as folks for whom Christ died, like, is ultimately misleading me. So better to have them in my house, like, better to fall back accidentally into liking them, right? Because all of that is truer. And again, I wanted to kind of trick my friends into seeing the truth. So one of the things I did when I had them all over for the cookies and the debate was that I deliberately ran a little late in getting ready. Sometimes I'm late for real, but I like started the cookies in the oven late on purpose. So when my friends came over, I'm like, hi everyone, like in my oven mitts, right? Like, sorry, I did not set up yet. Alexander and Trevor, could you move the couch for me? Alexander and Trevor were on opposite sides of the disagreement, right? Like, Adam and Christian, could you get out milk and cups? I just like paired people up to do productive things first on purpose, because they'd all agreed to come have this debate, right? To a certain extent, they'd all already agreed to share a project together. But I thought they wouldn't remember that in the middle of it, right? So I wanted us to start truthfully serving each other, depending on each other in that like very particular way you depend on someone else while you're carrying a heavy couch and they have the other end of it. And that was the truth. And that way we could approach the debate kind of embedded in the truth that we cared for each other and depended on each other, and that's why we were bothering to disagree with each other. So I think that's kind of a helpful thing, and if that means kind of having someone over to your house to make dinner while discussing, you know, provided you're really careful with the knives and the level at which you let the disagreement go, it's going to be a more truthful disagreement, a disagreement that's embedded in what is true, than one that kind of starts abstractly or distantly, or as though the fact of your disagreement is the real whole fact of your relationship together. Because ultimately, I don't want my disagreements to be adversarial. I want them to be like, or I want them to be adversarial the way the justice system is meant to be adversarial, where the two of us are working together by exploring our own sides as honestly and fiercely as possible in order that together we may find truth. Because when you're in a fight, the actual only thing you know for sure is that at least one of you is wrong. There's no promise that just because you have a disagreement, one of you is holding the correct position at the outset. It needs to be possible for either of us, or even both of us, to concede to truth as we seek it. I almost think about it as though we're both kind of in a foggy place with a patchy map, trying to survey the ground together with different tools and different assumptions, but we have to figure out where we actually are. And really, you know, if it feels like it makes you nervous to do this, if it feels like it could go apocalyptically wrong or even apocalyptically right, I think you're on the right track. Because I think, you know, even beyond the stakes of any disagreement we're having, that we can really see kind of healing up division between us as part of the work of Christ's salvation. And that's the stakes, even on a small scale fight or a personal fight or something you've been neglecting because it doesn't feel worth it to settle and you can just ignore each other, that we mean for every crooked thing to be made straight and every broken thing whole. And that my favorite framing of what a disagreement ultimately is comes from the travel writer Dame Rebecca West, who is an extremely opinionated English woman who traveled around in the Balkans between the two world wars. She was prone to making, you know, extremely broad statements about all the cultures she met. And the one that she said that I love is about the Slavic people she met. And she says, in the West, conversation is regarded as a means either of passing the time agreeably or exchanging useful information. Among Slavs, it is thought to be disgraceful when a number of people are together, if they do not pool their experience and thus travel further towards the redemption of the world. I think that's ultimately what all disagreements, important, petty, personal, political, are about. That we are all made to be one in Christ. And you know, whenever I'm trying to go through that arc for myself, from anger to curiosity to compassion, trying to give my opponent a way of seeing that I too am fighting out of love for a perceived good at the very least, you know, the closer we're getting to the bedrock truth that animates us both, and therefore the easier it is to explore whatever smaller truth that kind of prompted this. And it means that a fight doesn't just have to be kind of a way of making, I don't know, a kind of very sterile piece of like, well, I guess now we've finished arguing about this and we're just not mad anymore, right? That a goal isn't even just lowering tensions, finding a way to exist alongside each other, a kind of detente, dispassionate, closed off. But that the best argument will cause us to fall in passionate love with our antagonist, and they with us, and each of us with Christ within us. Thank you.